Well said, Barry applauded. I seem to have met a number of anthropologists lately. Is it a new specialty?
Yes. Pity there weren't more of us earlier. We've destroyed all that was good in so many places we've taken into the Empire. We hope never to make those mistakes again.
I suppose it must be something of a shock, said Blaine, to be brought into the Empire, like it or not, without warning, even if there weren't any other problems. Perhaps you should have stayed on New Chicago. Captain Chiller said he was having trouble governing the place.
I couldn't.
She looked moodily down at her plate, then glanced up with a forced smile.
Our first rule is that we must be sympathetic toward the people we study. And I hate that place, she added with venomous sincerity.
The emotion felt good. Even hatred was better than emptiness. Aye, Sinclair agreed. Anyone would, being kept in prison camp for months.
Worse than that, Commander. Dorothy disappeared. She was the girl I came with. She just vanished.
There was a long silence, and Sally was embarrassed.
Please, don't let me spoil our party.
Blaine was searching for something to say when Whitbread gave him his opportunity. At first, Blaine saw only that the junior midshipman was doing something under the edge of the table. But what? Tugging at the tablecloth, testing its tensile strength. And earlier, he'd been looking at the crystal. Yes, Mr. Whitbread, Rod said. It's very strong. Whitbread looked up, flushing. But Blaine didn't intend to embarrass the boy. Tablecloth, silverware, plates, platters, crystal, all have to be fairly durable, he told the company at large. Mere glassware wouldn't last the first battle. Our crystal is something else. It was cut from the wind screen of a wrecked First Empire re-entry vehicle. Or so I was told. It's certain we can't make such materials any longer. The linen isn't really linen either. It's an artificial fiber, also First Empire. The covers on the platters are crystal iron electroplated onto beaten gold.
It was the crystal I noticed first, Whitbread said diffidently.
So did I, some years ago. Blaine smiled at the middies. They were officers, but they were also teenage boys, and Rod could remember his days in the gunroom. More courses were brought to mix with shop talk scaled down for laymen, as Kelly orchestrated the dinner. Finally, the table was clear, except for coffee and wines. Mr. Vice, Blaine said formally. Whitbread, junior to Staley by 3 weeks, raised his glass.
Captain, my lady, His Imperial Majesty.
The officers lifted their glasses to their sovereign, as Navy men had done for 2,000 years.
You'll let me show you around my homeland? Sinclair asked anxiously.
Certainly. Thank you, but I don't know how long we'll be there.
Sally looked expectantly to Blaine. Nor I. We're to put in for a refit, and how long that takes is up to the yards.
Well, if it's not too long, I'll stay with you. Tell me, Commander, is there much traffic from New Scotland to the capital?
More than from most worlds this side of the coal sack, though that's nay saying a lot. Few ships with decent facilities for carrying passengers. Perhaps Mr. Barry can say more. His liners put into New Scotland.
But as you say, not to carry passengers. Our business is to disrupt interstellar trade, you know.
Barry saw quizzical looks. He continued, Imperial Autonetics is the business of transporting robotic factories. Whenever we can make something on a planet cheaper than others can ship it in, we set up plants. Our main competition's the merchant carriers. Barry poured himself another glass of wine, carefully selecting one that Blaine had said was in short supply. It must be a good one, otherwise the scarcity wouldn't have bothered the captain.
That's why I was on New Chicago when the rebellion broke out.
Nods of acceptance from Sinclair and Sally Fowler. Blaine with his posture too still and face too blank. Whitbread nudging Staley.
Wait till I tell you.
Gave Barry most of what he wanted to know. Suspicions, but nothing confirmed, nothing official.
You have a fascinating vocation, he told Sally before the silence could stretch. Tell us more, won't you? Have you seen many primitive worlds?
None at all, she said ruefully.
I know about them only from books. We would have gone on to visit Harlequin, but the rebellion... She stopped.
I was on Macassar once, said Blaine.
She brightened instantly. There was a whole chapter on that one. Very primitive, wasn't it?
It still is. There wasn't a big colony there to begin with. The whole industrial complex was smashed down to bedrock in the Secession Wars, and nobody visited the place for 400 years. They had an Iron Age culture by the time we got there. Swords, mail armor, wooden seagoing sailing ships.
But what were the people like? Sally asked eagerly. How did they live?
Rod shrugged, embarrassed. I was only there a few days. Hardly time enough to get the feel of a world. Years ago, when I was Staley's age, I remember mostly looking for a good tavern. After all, he wanted to add, I'm not an anthropologist. The conversation drifted on. Rod felt tired and looked for a polite opportunity to bring the dinner to a close. The others seemed rooted to their seats.
You study cultural evolution, Sinclair was saying earnestly, and perhaps that's wise. But could we nay have physical evolution as well? The First Empire was very large and sparsely spread, with room enough for almost anything. May we no find somewhere, off in some neglected corner of the old empire, a planet full of supermen?
Both midshipmen looked suddenly alert. Barry asked, What would physical evolution of humans bring, my lady?
They used to teach us that evolution of intelligent beings wasn't possible, she said. Societies protect their weaker members. Civilizations tend to make wheelchairs and spectacles and hearing aids as soon as they have the tools for them. When a society makes war, the men generally have to pass a fitness test before they're allowed to risk their lives. I suppose it helps win the war, she smiled. But it leaves precious little room for the survival of the fittest.
But suppose, Whitbread suggested, suppose a culture were knocked even further back than Macassar, all the way to complete savagery, clubs and fire. There'd be evolution then, wouldn't there?
3 glasses of wine had overcome Sally's black mood, and she was eager to talk of professional matters. Her uncle often told her she talked too much for a lady, and she tried to watch herself. But wine always did it to her. Wine and a ready audience. It felt good after weeks of nothingness.
Certainly, she said. Until a society evolved, you'd have natural selection until enough humans got together to protect each other from the environment. But it isn't long enough. Mr. Whitbread, there is a world where they practice ritual infanticide. The elders examine children and kill the ones who don't conform to their standards of perfection. It's not evolution exactly, but you might get some results that way, except that it hasn't been long enough.
People breed horses and dogs, Rod observed.
Yes, but they haven't gotten a new species. Ever. And societies can't keep constant rules long enough to make any real changes in the human race. Come again in 1,000,000 years. Of course, there were the deliberate attempts to breed supermen, like Sauron system.
Sinclair grunted.
Those beasties, he spat. 'Twas they started the secession wars and nearly killed the lot of us.
He stopped suddenly as Midshipman Whitbread cleared his throat.
Sally jumped into the lull.
That's another system I can't be sympathetic with. Although they're Empire loyalists now... She looked around.
Everyone had a strange look, and Sinclair was trying to hide his face behind a tilted wine glass. Midshipman Horst Staley's angular face might have been carved from stone.
What's the matter? She asked.
There was a long silence. Finally, Whitbread spoke.
Mr. Staley is from Sauron system, my lady.
I'm sorry, Sally blurted. I guess I really put my foot in it, didn't I? Really, Mr. Staley, I'm...
If my young gentlemen can't take that much pressure, I don't need them in my ship, Rod said. And you weren't the only one to put your foot in it. He looked significantly at Sinclair. We don't judge men by what their home worlds did hundreds of years ago.
Damn, that sounds stilted.
You were saying about evolution?
It
It ought to be pretty well closed off for an intelligent species, she said. Species evolve to meet the environment. An intelligent species changes the environment to suit itself. As soon as a species becomes intelligent, it should stop evolving. A pity we don't have any others for comparison, Barry said easily. Only a few fancied ones. He told a long story about an improbably intelligent octopoid meeting a centaur, and everyone laughed. Well, Captain, it was a fine dinner, Barry ended. Yes, Rod stood and offered Sally his arm, and the others scrambled to their feet. She was quiet again as he escorted her through the corridor to her cabin, and only polite as they parted. Rod went back to the bridge. More repairs had to be recorded into the ship's brain. 4. Priority OC. Hyperspace travel can be strange and frustrating. It takes an immeasurably short time to travel between stars. But as the line of travel, or tram line, exists only along one critical path between each pair of stars, never quite a straight line, but close enough to visualize it so, and the endpoints of the paths are far from the distortions in space caused by stars and large planetary masses, it follows that a ship spends most of its time crawling from one endpoint to another. Worse than that, not every pair of stars is joined by tram lines. Pathways are generated along lines of equipotential thermonuclear flux, and the presence of other stars in the geometric pattern can prevent the pathway from existing at all. Of those links that do exist, not all have been mapped. They are difficult to find. MacArthur's passengers found that travel aboard an Imperial warship was akin to imprisonment. The crew had duties to perform and repairs to make, even when off watch. The passengers had each other's company and what social life Navy routine would permit. There was no place for the entertainment facilities that luxury liners would carry. It was boring. By the time MacArthur was ready for her last jump, the passengers saw their arrival in New Caledonia as a release from jail. New Caledonia. Star system behind the coal sack with F8 primary star cataloged as Murchison A. The distant binary, Murchison B, is not part of the New Caledonia system. Murchison A has 6 planets in 5 orbits, with 4 inner planets, a relatively wide gap containing the debris of an unformed planet, and 2 outer planets in a Trojan relationship. The 4 inner planets are named Concubber, New Ireland, New Scotland, and Fummer, in their order from the Sun, which is known locally as Cal, or Old Cal, or the Sun. The middle 2 planets are inhabited, both terraformed by First Empire scientists, after Jasper Murchison, who was related to Alexander IV, persuaded the Council that the New Caledonian system would be the proper place to establish an imperial university. It is now known that Murchison was primarily interested in having an inhabited planet near the red supergiant known as Murchison's Eye. And as he was not satisfied with the climate of New Ireland, demanded the terraforming of New Scotland as well. Fummer is a relatively small planet, with almost no atmosphere, and few interesting features. It does, however, possess several fungi, which are biologically related to other fungi found in the trans-coal sack sector, and their manner of transmission to Fummer has stimulated an endless controversy in the Journal of the Imperial Society of Xenobiologists, since no other life forms native to New Caledonia exist. The 2 outer planets occupy the same orbit, and are named Dagda and Mider, in keeping with the system's Celtic mythological nomenclature. Dagda is a gas giant, and the Empire maintains fuel stations on the planet's 2 moons, Angus and Bridget. Merchant ships are cautioned that Bridget is a navy base, and may not be approached without permission. Mider is a cold metal ball, extensively mined, and troublesome to cosmologists, because its manner of formation does not appear to conform to either of the 2 major contending theories of planetary origin. New Scotland and New Ireland, the only inhabited planets of the system, had extensive atmospheres of water vapor and methane when discovered,
but no free oxygen. Biological packages in massive quantities transformed them into inhabitable worlds, at considerable cost. Toward the end of the project, Murchison lost his influence in the council, but by then the investment was so high that the project was carried on to completion. In less than 100 years of intensive effort, the domed colonies became open colonies, one of the most triumphant accomplishments of the First Empire. Both worlds were partially depopulated during the Secession Wars, with New Ireland joining the rebel forces, while New Scotland remained staunchly loyalist. After interstellar travel was lost in the trans-coal sack sector, New Scotland continued the struggle until its rediscovery by the Second Empire. As a consequence, New Scotland is the trans-coal sack sector capital. MacArthur shuddered and dropped into existence beyond the orbit of Dagda. For long moments, her crew sat at their hyperspace transition stations, disoriented, fighting to overcome the confusion that always follows instantaneous travel. Why? One branch of physics at the Imperial University of Sigismund contends that hyperspace travel requires not zero time, but transfinite time, and that this produces the characteristic confusion of both men and computer equipment. Other theories suggest that the jump produces stretching or shrinking of local space, affecting nerves and computer elements alike, or that not all parts of the ship appear at the same time, or that inertia and mass vary on a subatomic level after transition. No one knows, but the effect is real.
"Helmsman," Blaine said thickly, his eyes slowly focused on the bridge displays.
"Aye, aye, sir."
The voice was numbed and uncomprehending, but the crewman automatically responded.
"Set a course for Dagda. Get her moving."
"Aye, aye."
In the early days of hyperspace travel, ships' computers had tried to accelerate immediately after pop-out. It didn't take long to find out that computers were even more confused than men. Now all automatic equipment was turned off for transition. Lights flashed on Blaine's displays as crewmen slowly reactivated MacArthur and checked out their systems.
"We'll put her down on Bridget, Mr. Renner," Blaine continued. "Make your velocity match. Mr. Staley, you will assist the sailing master."
"Aye, aye, sir."
The bridge came back to life. Crewmen stirred and returned to duties. Stewards brought coffee after acceleration and gravity returned. Men left hyperspace stations to return to patrol duties, while MacArthur's artificial eyes scanned space for enemies. The trouble board flashed green as each station reported successful transition. Blaine nodded in satisfaction as he sipped his coffee. It was always like this, and after hundreds of transitions, he still felt it. There was something basically wrong with instantaneous travel, something that outraged the senses, something the mind wouldn't accept at a level below thought. The habits of the service carried men through. These two were ingrained at a level more basic than intellectual functions.
"Mr. Whitbread, my compliments to the Chief Yeoman of Signals, and please report us into Fleet Headquarters on New Scotland. Get our course and speed from Staley, and you can signal the fuel station on Bridget that we're coming in. Inform Fleet of our destination."
"Aye, aye, sir." "Signal in 10 minutes, sir?"
"Yes." Whitbread unbuckled from his command seat behind the captain and walked drunkenly to the helm station.
"I'll need full engine power for a signal in 10 minutes, Horst."
He made his way from the bridge, recovering rapidly. Young men usually did, which was one reason for having young officers in command of the ships.
"Now hear this," Staley announced. The call sounded through the ship. "Now hear this. End of acceleration in 10 minutes. Brief period of free fall in 10 minutes.
"But why?" Blaine heard. He looked up to see Sally Fowler at the bridge entranceway. His invitation to the passengers to come to the bridge when there was no emergency had worked out fine. Barry hardly ever made use of the privilege.
"Why freefall so soon?" she asked.
"Need the power to make a signal," Blaine answered. "At this distance, it'll use up a significant part of our engine power to produce the maser beam. We could overload the engines if we had to,
But it's standard to coast for messages if there's no real hurry.
Oh.
She sat in Whitbread's abandoned chair. Rod swiveled his command seat to face her, wishing again that someone would design a free-fall outfit for girls that didn't cover so much of their legs, or that brief shorts would come back into fashion. Right now, skirts were down to calves on Sparta, and the provinces copied the capital. For shipboard wear, the designers produced pantaloon things, comfortable enough, but baggy.
"When do we get to New Scotland?" she asked.
"Depends on how long we stay off Dagda. Sinclair wants to do some outside work while we're dirtside."
He took out his pocket computer and wrote quickly with the attached stylus.
"Let's see, we're about 1.5 billion kilometers from New Scotland. That's, make it 100 hours to turn over. About 200 hours travel time, plus what we spend on Dagda. And the time it takes to get to Dagda, of course. That's not so far, about 20 hours from here."
"So we'll still be a couple of weeks, at least," she said. "I thought once we got here we'd—"
She broke off, laughing.
"It's silly. Why can't you invent something that lets you jump around in interplanetary space? There's something faintly ridiculous about it. We went 5 light-years in no time at all. Now it takes weeks to get to New Scotland."
"Tired of us so soon?" "It's worse than that, really. It takes an insignificant part of our hydrogen to make a jump. Well, it isn't trivial, but it's not a lot compared to what it'll take getting to New Scotland. I don't have enough fuel aboard to go direct. In fact, not in less than a year. But there's more than enough to make a jump. All that takes is enough energy to get into hyperspace."
Sally snared a cup of coffee from the steward. She was learning to drink Navy coffee, which wasn't like anything else in the galaxy.
"So we just have to put up with it," she said.
"Afraid so. I've been on trips where it was faster to drive over to another Alderson point, make a jump, move around in the new system, jump somewhere else, keep doing that until you come back to the original system at a different place. Do all that, and it would still be faster than merely to sail across the original system in normal space. But not this time. The geometry isn't right."
"Pity," she laughed. "We'd see more of the universe for the same price."
She didn't say she was bored, but Rod thought she was, and there wasn't much he could do about it. He had little time to spend with her, and there weren't many sights to see.
"Now hear this. Stand by for freefall."
She barely had time to strap herself in before the drive cut out. Chief Yeoman of Signals, Lute Shattuck, squinted into his aiming sight, his knobby fingers making incredibly fine adjustments for such clumsy appendages. Outside MacArthur's home, a telescope hunted under Shattuck's guidance until it found a tiny dot of light. It hunted again until the dot was perfectly centered. Shattuck grunted in satisfaction and touched a switch. A maser antenna slaved itself to the telescope, while the ship's computer decided where the dot of light would be when the message arrived. A coded message wound off its tape reel, while aft, MacArthur's engines fused hydrogen to helium. Energy rode out through the antenna, energy modulated by the thin tape in Shattuck's cubicle, reaching toward New Scotland. Rod was at dinner alone in his cabin when the reply arrived. A duty yeoman looked at the heading and shouted for Chief Shattuck. 4 minutes later, Midshipman Whitbread knocked at his captain's door.
"Yes," Rod answered irritably.
"Message from Fleet Admiral Cranston, sir."
Rod looked up in irritation. He hadn't wanted to eat alone, but the wardroom had invited Sally Fowler to dinner. It was their turn, after all. And if Blaine had invited himself to dine with his officers, Mr. Barry would have come too. Now even this miserable dinner was interrupted.
"Can't it wait?"
"It's priority OC, sir."
"A hot flash for us, OC?" Blaine stood abruptly, the protein aspic forgotten.
"Read it to me, Mr. Whitbread."
"Yes, sir. MacArthur, from Imp Fleet New, Scott, OC, OC, 8175.
"You may omit the authentication codes, Midshipman. I assume you checked them out."
"Yes, sir. Anyway, sir, date, code. Message begins. You will proceed with all possible speed
Repeat all possible speed to Bridget for refueling with priority double A. 1. Stop. You will refuel in minimum possible time. Stop. Paragraph. MacArthur will then proceed to... sir, it gives some coordinate points in the new CAL system. Or any other vector, your choice to intercept and investigate mysterious object entering New Caledonia system from normal space. Repeat, normal space. Stop. Object proceeds along galactic vector. It gives a course from the general direction of the coal sack, sir. At a speed of approximately 7% velocity of light. Stop. Object is decelerating rapidly. Stop. Imperial University astronomers say spectrum of intruder is spectrum of new Cal sun blue shifted. Stop. Obvious conclusion that intruder is powered by light sail. Stop. Paragraph. Imperial University astronomers certain object is artifact constructed by intelligent beings. Stop. FYI, no known human colonies at apparent origin of intruder. Stop. Paragraph. Cruiser Lermontov dispatched to assist but cannot arrive to match velocity with intruder until 71 hours after minimum time MacArthur velocity match with object. Stop. Proceed with caution. Stop. You are to assume intruder is hostile until otherwise assured. Stop. You are ordered to use caution, but do not initiate hostilities. Repeat, do not initiate hostilities. Stop. Break, break. Go get it, chiller. Stop. Wish I was out there. Stop. Godspeed. Stop. Cranston. Break. Message ends authentication. That's it, sir.
Whitbread was breathless.
That's it. That's quite a lot, Mr. Whitbread.
Blaine fingered the intercom switch.
Wardroom.
Wardroom, aye aye, Captain,
Midshipman Staley answered.
Get me Cargill. The first lieutenant sounded resentful when he came on. Blaine was intruding on his dinner party. Rod felt an inner satisfaction for doing it.
Jack, get to the bridge. I want this bird moving. I'll have a minimum time course to land us on Bridget, and I mean minimum. You can run the tanks, but get us there fast.
Aye, aye, sir. Passengers aren't going to like it.
Rape the...
My compliments to the passengers, and this is a fleet emergency.
Too bad about your dinner party, Jack, but get your passengers into hydraulic beds and move this ship. I'll be on the bridge in a minute.
Yes, sir.
The intercom went silent for a moment, then Staley's voice hooted through the ship.
Now hear this, now hear this. Stand by for prolonged acceleration above 2 gravities. Department heads signal when secured for increased acceleration.
Okay, Blaine said. He turned to Whitbread. Punch that damned vector designation into the computer, and let's see where the hell that intruder comes from. He realized he was swearing, and made an effort to calm down. Intruders? Aliens? Good God, what a break. To be in command of the first ship to make contact with aliens. Let's just see where they're from, shall we?
Whitbread moved to the input console next to Blaine's desk. The screen swam violently, then flashed numbers.
Blast your eyes, Whitbread. I'm not a mathematician. Put it on a graph.
Sorry, sir.
Whitbread fiddled with the input controls again. The screen became a black volume filled with blobs and lines of colored light. Big blobs were stars colored for type. Velocity vectors were narrow green lines. Acceleration vectors were lavender. Projected paths were dimly lit red curves. The long green line...
Blaine looked at the screen in disbelief, then laid his finger along the knot in his nose. From the moat. Well, I will be go to hell. From the moat in normal space.
There was no known tram line to the intruder's star. It hung in isolation, a yellow fleck near the supergiant Murkison's eye. Visions of octopoids danced in his head. Suppose they were hostile, he thought suddenly. If old Mac had to fight an alien ship, she'd need more work. Work they'd put off because it ought to be done in orbit, or dirtside, and now they'd have to do it at 2+G. But it was MacArthur's baby, and his. Somehow they'd do it.
5. The Face of God.